Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Filmspotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
The Sessions is now available on demand, featuring an Oscar-nominated performance from Helen Hunt. Robot and Frank is also available, starring Frank Langella with Peter Sarsgaard as the voice of the robot.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The Art House is now in your house.
This podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/SVU. From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And this week on the show, we channel our need for speed and giving windmill high fives into our review of 1986's Top Gun.
They get the need for speed thing in there within the first 60 seconds.
It was necessary.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Later, we'll bring you Q Shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites. All centered around a common theme and inspired by Top Gun. I would have been so excited for this. We were going to do an all Kenny Loggins podcast, but then we thought rights issues, the guy we were going to get to accompany us on guitar flaked out. I didn't want to do the whole thing a cappella, so I said, this is it. Instead, we're going to look at some other definitive 80s movies.
But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight one title that's new on VOD and give you a rundown of some other notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, what's our first pick this week?
This is it. It being our pick. I think people really enjoyed us singing Top Gun last time, so I'm just going to start. Pretty soon, this show will be sung. It'll be like
it'll
cop
be,
rock.
It'll be just the Les Mis of podcasts.
Exactly, yes.
Movie our podcast. Pick this week, Allison, is called...
It's called In Our Nature. This is a really, really nice little film. I saw it at South by Southwest 2012, where it unfortunately seemed to get lost in the shuffle a little bit. Maybe that's not too surprising because it's a very small-scale film. It's not very flashy. But if you're a fan of character dramas, if you're a fan of the kind of stuff that like BBS used to make in the 1970s, kind of that, maybe not dark, but adult, serious, you know, new Hollywood dramas, this is going to be something you're going to want to see. For the cast, if nothing else, it's got Gabrielle Union, Jenna Malone, Zach Guilford from Friday Night Lights, Matt Saracen, and John Slattery from Mad Men, a fantastic cast. Slattery and Guilford play estranged father and son who, through an accident of scheduling, both wind up at their family's vacation home on the same weekend with their girlfriends. That's Guilford with Malone and then Slattery with Gabrielle Union. And then the four of them have to kind of find a way to share this place very uncomfortably.
I've never met him, and I think it's just weird to run away.
If you really wanted to, maybe you could stay for dinner.
I'm actually a vegan.
Are you a vegan too?
No, I'm vegetarian.
Okay.
So this is how you're trying to make up for it?
Make up for what?
How things went with your first family.
Did it ever occur to you you might be happy for me?
You can get a new house, you can get a new wife, you can get a new son, but I can't get a new dad.
You think this just happened to you? We both made a choice. You didn't choose me, and I didn't choose you.
So it's basically The Great Outdoors, if you remember that movie, Allison, but it's serious and nuanced instead of, you know, really silly and broad. Nothing spectacular about it necessarily, except the cast. And if you're a fan of John Slattery on Mad Men, oh man, he is really great in this. Not quite as, you know, flamboyant as he is in that, but he has a few really standout scenes. There's a great scene where he smokes a joint with Jenna Malone, and it's like the first joint he's smoked in a long time, but he sort of like, as he does it, you can see he like gets back into doing it, and he's like a master pot smoker. It's really, really outstanding. That scene alone is almost worth the price of admission by itself. Again, this is a small scale film, but sometimes I find that those are the best movies to look at on VOD anyway. So that's In Our Nature, directed by Brian Savilson, and it's now available on VOD. Allison, do we have a few more picks this week?
We do, and all of these are currently available now on demand. The first one is Brooklyn Castle. This is a little documentary that actually ended up getting a lot of attention. It's directed by Katie Dellamaggiore, and it is about a middle school in Brooklyn that happens to have one of the best chess teams in the country. And in general, it's always adorable to watch in documentaries kids doing like very grown-up things, right? Like ballroom dancing or devoting themselves very seriously to word roots to learn spelling, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And this does offer that as well. But it is a really interesting look at after-school programs and like a kind of great case for how important they can be. You know, this is a public school in Brooklyn, so its kids are very diverse and they come from all different backgrounds and are oftentimes not, you know, if you associate chess with elderly white men, which is probably unfair, but like is some maybe a kind of your stereotypical tendency. It's great to see this young community of people who are like so dedicated to chess and take it very seriously. So it's a really interesting doc. That's Brooklyn Castle. Also, new on demand, Celeste and Jesse Forever, directed by Lee Tolan Krieger and written by Rashida Jones, who also stars in the movie, along with Will McCormick. You know, this movie, I really, it surprised me. I liked it a lot. It offered this very, it's not necessarily that cute, I think. Like, it offers a portrayal of a relationship that you think is going to be very twee. Jones stars in the film alongside Andy Samberg as a couple who married very young and are separating, except they still spend all of their time together. And I think it actually got at some pretty interesting and dark and kind of honest things about friendship versus romance and about how you can kind of try and keep someone around even when it's unfair to them. And I think so it's like it was kind of a nice story about growing up and growing apart. So that's Celeste and Jesse Forever. And finally, a film I haven't seen but has also gotten I think a lot of attention as given that it's a pretty quiet film. It's A Late Quartet, directed by Yaron Zilberman. And stars Philip Seymour Hoffman, Katherine Keener, Christopher Walken, Wallace Shawn. It's about a string quartet who has been together for 25 years and about all of the complicated dynamics in it, particularly when the oldest member of the quartet learns that he's going to have to give it up, that he's because of an illness. And, you know, with a cast like that, you know that you're going to at least get great performances. So that's one I'm really interested in checking out. That is A Late Quartet. We've also got Audible back as a sponsor this week. Audible is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. Matt, do you have a recommended title this week?
I do. It's the book I'm reading right now, actually. It's called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, written by Sean Howe and narrated unabridged for 17 something hours by Stephen Hoy. This is a lengthy history of the repeated rises and falls of Marvel Comics, the house of ideas that gave us Spider-Man and the X-Men and the Avengers and many, many more characters. And while I've read a lot of books about the history of the comic book business, Men of Tomorrow, Tales to Astonish, Stan Lee, and the Rise and Fall of the American Comic Book, this one, I think, gives a little bit of a different perspective on it in that it really just focuses on this one company. So while you get characters like Stan Lee, like Jack Kirby in it, you also get a sense of the management of the company and how they treated the artists, the freelancers, how they took their creations in many cases for very little money and just profited off them for decades and let their creators basically just fade into obscurity and suffer sometimes in old age. These really sad fates because they didn't get a share of the revenues that these creations generated for these huge companies. But that's really, I think, the background. Mainly, if you're curious about Marvel Comics, if you see these movies coming out now and you go, how did this happen? How did we get this company becoming this billion-dollar juggernaut in the entertainment industry? This is going to give you a very good look at that in an entertaining form. It's Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, and you can get it for free on Audible.
for Marvel Comics The Untold Story or another free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/SVU. That's audiblepodcast.com/SVU. Try to be best, cause you're only a man, and a man's got to learn to do. Try to believe, though the going gets rough, that you got a handcuff to make it. History repeats itself, try and you succeed. Never doubt that you're the one, and you can have a dream. You're the best around.
Okay, there you're hearing some of the dulcet tones of Joe Esposito and his classic song, You're the Best, from The Karate Kid, which may come up a little later in this segment, which is Cue Shots. And we're going to be talking about 80s movies. And one of the things I wanted to get across as we're talking in a general way, first of all, was as I was looking at lists of 80s movies and thinking about it, it's like every classic 80s movie, or almost every classic 80s movie, has a theme song or a musical moment that defines it. And it's not just this is not like a Martin Scorsese take Be My Baby and put it in my movie and give it a new meaning. This is the song almost has no meaning outside or before the movie that it's in. So in this case, when you hear You're the Best, you don't think of anything except Karate Kid, except Daniel Russo fighting in the All-Valley Karate Tournament. You know, that's it. That's what it is. And I think most of the movies we're going to recommend here are going to have maybe even more than one moment like that. Allison, do you have any thoughts why that might be? Why the 80s we so closely define with musical moments and theme songs, and why that became such a trend in the 80s?
I don't know. Part of me wants to give what is probably the cynical answer and say, like, soundtracks were commodities then.
Right.
You know, like, Top Gun, which we'll talk about later, had, I think it went 9 times platinum. Like, that's incredible. You
guys,
know?
The music in Top Gun is not that good. But you're right. It was a huge phenomenon.
It was huge, yeah. And I wonder if the 80s were also maybe the prime decade of the blockbuster, right? Which started in the mid-70s with Jaws and then really came into its own in the 80s. And I think that all of the films we talk about in this section are like big successes.
Right. So maybe this was a refinement of the blockbuster as money-making strategy, perhaps.
Yeah,
that another revenue stream that you could bring from a movie was to make some sort of song that you could market along with it.
Right. Well, because also, it's interesting reading about a lot of the films that we picked, or like other ones that some key 80s movies, a lot of them were not on streaming, but you know,
yes,
that they often spawned merchandising, or not even just merchandising, but like sales of like aviator sunglasses for Top
right.
Gun went, you know, through the roof, bomber jackets, haircuts. Like there was a
connection
impact
between the zeitgeist and like marketing. It was like if you could like catch a trend and then sell it, you could not only like boost the sales of your movie, the ticket sales, you could almost boost the trend, whatever you were piggybacking off of, whether it was aerobics, whether it was, you know, really nice suits, whether it was, I remember, and like, when you say 80s movies, even though we're not going to talk about it on the show, I think of like Batman is a very definitive 80s movie in terms of this thing we're talking about, this phenomenon of marketing and merchandising. And I remember kids in my neighborhood getting the Batman logo shaved into their heads, which is so incredibly stupid, but it happened. I can think of like 2 different kids on my block that had it. And I can remember going to my mother and be like, let's do that. And she's like, no,
absolutely
that
not.
Is not happening. So then I did it to myself. No, I'm just kidding.
It's still there. I can see it.
In terms of the music, the other thing I we have to at least mention is MTV. I think that became, you know, obviously that was the decade of MTV as a music hub. And that became another way to advertise your movie, you know, put a song in it, make a music video, and then put it on the network, and you've got another way of selling your movie. So I think that probably played a role as well. Did we have any defining characteristics to the 80s movie? For me, like, I wasn't looking for the best movie of the 1980s. We were, when we say 80s movies, we were when you close your eyes and I say the phrase 80s movies, these are the movies that come to your head. Not necessarily Raging Bull, which might be like the greatest movie of the 80s, but that's not what I think of. I think we're thinking of something else. So, and I think you already mentioned, not everything you think of is on streaming. Like for me, like the 2 first movies that come to my head neither one are really available on streaming right now. It would be like Ghostbusters and Wall Street. Those to me are almost like the two defining 80s movies in some ways. They might make an interesting double feature. They're both about capitalism in different ways. But those are not available on streaming. But I think we've got some very iconic 80s movies here, and maybe a little less iconic to give people some recommendations that are a little more off the beaten path. Are you going to start? Do you want me to start?
I think you should start. We actually both have one film on in our picks that we had not seen before.
Right.
So with fresh eyes, we look back at this other era.
Right. And they're both produced by perhaps the key producing duo of the 1980s, which in my mind is Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, who really pioneered the formula that we were just talking about, where the blockbuster with all these different added bonuses. They always had a theme song. They always had these incredible montages. They always brought a little bit of not only music and making music a sellable element, but bringing like the idea of music video editing to their movies. And I think that's something we could talk about with Top Gun a little bit later. I really felt that watching that movie. But really, it's a perfect segue into my first pick, which was produced by Bruckheimer and Simpson. This was really their first movie as a producing team, and it was a surprise hit. I had never seen it before, and it's called Flashdance from 1983. It was directed by Adrian Lyne, who is another very successful director of the 1980s. He directed this. He directed Fatal Attraction, which is another iconic 1980s movie, which I actually think is also available on streaming. Flashdance is available on Netflix, and this stars Jennifer Beals in what has to be her most famous role, right?
Definitely, it is, yeah.
And what's so interesting about it is it's her most famous role, maybe her only famous role. And what made the movie famous, what made her famous, is something she did not actually do, which is the dancing in the movie. She did not flash dance. For the most part, the dancing was performed by a body double. Her name was Maureen Jahan. And what's fascinating watching this movie, at least from my perspective now in 2013, is it is so obvious that Jennifer Beals is not dancing in this movie. I've never seen a dance movie that went to more pains to hide the face of the person who's dancing. When she's dancing in the beginning of the movie with that iconic shot, which is, Allison, what? The most famous shot in Flashdance. The water splashing down.
Yes.
Come on!
I was like, are you talking about the audition at the end?
No, well, that's famous too, but you know, that she's sitting in the chair and she gets
and
water splashed.
Yes, of course.
Which would really be an unsanitary thing for an exotic dancing club to do.
There are a lot of questions I have about the club that we can discuss in a bit.
Okay, but I can't wait to do that. But yeah, I mean, that whole scene is basically backlit in the extreme, so that, and you can never see her face. Catch my eye. Well, he's lucky he just walked on by. But he hasn't met a girl like me and you kill him. Well, I tell him that I'd rather die. And I think that's really fascinating that this movie is about this girl who's got these dreams. I'm going to be a dancer as long as my body double shows up in time to do these scenes for me. Anyway, yes, she is an exotic dancer by day and also a welder by day. She has two jobs. The story here is almost shockingly simplistic. It is, she is a welder and also an exotic dancer, and she dreams of being like in a conservatory. She wants a job.
She wants to be a real classy dancer type.
Yeah. But she's afraid. She's afraid because she has these because she break dances and she does all these crazy dance moves at her exotic dancing. She doesn't think she'll get in. And it takes her new boyfriend, and it takes her grandmother, and it takes a friend to convince her to audition. And that's all. That's the entire movie. Like, there's no villain per se. There's a couple of minor villains. There's a few subplots about her friends who work at this exotic dancing club with her, another fellow dancer, the cook who wants to be a stand-up comic. But that's it. There's no plot in this movie. It is just dancing and welding and Jennifer Beals looking cute in a sweatshirt that's all out of proportion. And it's just a Steel Town girl on a Saturday night, Alice, and that's it. I could not believe how simplistic this movie was. I'll go out on a limb. I'll say it was only successful because of the dancing, because of the music, which is brilliantly chosen. You know, those famous songs, Maniac and What a Feeling. And that's it. why was this movie so successful, Allison? Was that it? It just caught on? It just hit the right mix of music, and it had those a few iconic images they could put in a trailer, like her splashing water on herself?
It was an underdog story. You know, it was about having a dream. I would also like to say, she's not even really an exotic dancer. I think this is the thing that's like important to say about the bar dancing.
Well, what is she?
I don't know. That's the thing, is like, she doesn't strip, right?
She does a little stripping in that first dance. She does take a few of her clothes off.
Yeah.
But again, she's so backlit, you can barely see it. And then the rest of it, you're right, it's just sort of like gigolo dancing. Is that a thing? Did I just make up a thing?
Gigolo dancing. But I mean, like,
I don't know.
So it is weird in that it's not like she's...
But she's also like dancing in her underwear.
Right.
And then later her friend goes to like a legit strip club.
Exactly.
And then she has like a moral moment. She like pulls the girl out and she's like, "You're better than this."
Exactly.
And I'm like, is she really that much better than this?
Exactly.
Is it really so bad to be obviously she's not making enough money at this crappy exotic non-strip club because she's got to be a welder.
Yes.
People be exotic dancers so they don't have to do other jobs. That's the job you do so you don't have to have a day job. So obviously this place isn't paying her enough. So maybe she should go to... Anyway, we're getting off track. Do I think it's a good movie? No, I don't. But I do think it's a fascinating movie. I was riveted by this movie because it was so simple and basic in a way that I guess made it so popular. It was, like you said, underdog story. Boom, everyone's got it. Dancing. Everyone loves dancing. And the dancing is really cool. I will say that. But yeah, other than that, I was just like mesmerized by how basic it is. Flashdance, available on Netflix. What's your first pick, Allison?
My first pick is Beverly Hills Cop, the first installment in what became a trilogy. I had never seen the first installment. I'd seen the second, like, a long time ago. And
directed by Tony Scott.
Directed by Tony Scott.
And they're all produced by, or at least the first two are produced by Bruckheimer Simpson.
Yes.
Who also produced Top Gun. So we're really bringing it all together.
Bringing it all together here. The third one was in the 90s. It did not come around until the 90s. By that point, the franchise was pretty beaten to the ground.
Yeah, the third one's horrible.
Yes. But 1984, Beverly Hills Cop, streaming on Netflix, directed by Martin Brest, who also did Scent of a Woman, Meet Joe Black, and Geely, starring Eddie Murphy as Detroit Police Detective Axel Foley. This was actually nominated for a Best Screenplay Academy Award.
Wow.
So think about that. Also really interesting, before Murphy came to the role, Mickey Rourke was slated to take it, and then Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, that's the famous one. And it was supposed to be a deadly serious movie.
Right, exactly.
About
it was gritty.
A tough guy from Detroit, investigating a case in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And then he, I guess, dropped out or didn't want to do it, and then they brought in Eddie Murphy.
And it became an action comedy. It is, I have to say, I was surprised watching this how relatively subdued on the scale of Eddie Murphy this role is. Like, he has a few big moments, particularly the first time we see him when he's undercover selling cigarettes.
Yes.
Where he's like, Eddie Murphy. But then, actually, otherwise, there's a lot of almost serious drama, kind of the undercurrent, because his best friend, or like this friend he had from back in the day, comes to see him,
right?
And they hang out, and then this friend is killed. And that's the plot, is that he goes to track him down where he was working in Beverly Hills to figure out what happened. So, like, you know, he's very serious about finding out what happened to his friend.
Tell me something, fella. What's going on? I've been here too long. Talk to me.
Yeah, just give us a minute, okay?
No, I ain't got no more minutes. Here, check this out. I want you to see something. You can't get no cleaner than this here. Look here. He's a very popular cigarette with the children. You know what this is in here? You know what this is? It's a federal tax stamp. You can't beat that. You can't get no cleaner than that. Talk to me. Tell me something.
So why don't you keep me going to business yourself? This is such a great fucking deal.
I would, man, but I ain't from Detroit, you know, and I don't know nobody in town that can handle a job this big, but y'all supposed to got all the connections, you know? But tell me something. Shit, I'm a businessman. I'm going to sit down. Do what you want to do.
You're right. It ain't easy to get rid of this shit.
But see, I'm a businessman, you know? This is my thing. I'm doing business here.
For a fish-out-of-water story, it actually doesn't lean that heavily on that aspect. I was expecting a lot more, like...
wackiness?
This is, you know...
No, it's a crime. It's a cop movie.
It is absolutely a cop movie. And, you know, it plays off the dynamic between him and then Judge Reinhold and John Ashton... was Detective Billy Rosewood and his partner, Taggart.
Rosewood and Taggart, baby. Oh,
who are
yeah.
pretty charming together.
Absolutely.
I think they have a really nice dynamic as, like, this kind of... they've obviously been partners for a while, and Rosewood is the kind of naive one, and Taggart is always a little exasperated with him. And, you know, you have some famous moments, including Axel putting bananas in the tailpipe of their car. Does that work? I don't know, but I'm sure many people tried it after seeing it in the movie.
I guarantee. I don't know. I would bet all the money in the world that there's a MythBusters about it, though.
I'm sure there is. But you
can,
know,
can you stop a car with a banana in the tailpipe?
Three bananas.
Oh, it's three.
Yeah, it
okay,
is.
Good.
Yeah.
Glad we cleared that up.
But, you know, this is a movie that basically, and I think that this is something we can talk about coming around to Top Gun as well, it is a movie that rests very heavily on the charisma of Eddie Murphy. It basically, it's a pretty slack story in terms of the crime that's being solved. It's about an evil gallery
well,
owner.
It's funny you say that because I think John Landis, who ended up directing the third Beverly Hills Cop, has gone on record saying that when he read the script for Beverly Hills Cop, because they wanted him to direct it, he thought it was like the worst script he had ever read, you know, when it was a Stallone thing. But then the movie was so great because basically Eddie Murphy just, you know, he took over
he
and
carries it.
He
yes.
carries it. Exactly. So that was why he made the third one, because he was like, well, the script is terrible, but Eddie Murphy will save it, just like he did the first one. It didn't
yes.
maybe work out that
didn't
way.
Work
but
out so well. But like, yeah. you know, he is really, he's very charismatic in this role, as
Absolutely.
Much as like there are whole parts of this movie where you feel like there's like almost no forward motion, and yet he makes it work. He makes it completely watchable.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, that you're what you could also be describing Flashdance.
Yes.
I mean, it's really about Jennifer Beals, who even though she's not doing the dancing, she is a striking presence. She's
yeah.
beautiful, and she's sort of interestingly beautiful. You know, she's quirky, and the camera does love her, and that's a big part of it. And there is no plot in that movie. It's just watching her dancing and dreaming and all that sort of thing. And we could basically do this for all of the Simpson-Bruckheimer movies. That's what I think was so interesting when I watched these movies and thought about it. I wrote a piece on CriticWire this week on my blog, which you can find if you just search my name and the Bruckheimer hero. They're all about the same character, all of their movies. It doesn't matter what genre, whether it's a dancing movie, whether it's a cop movie, whether it's a fighter pilot movie. That main character is always the same. It's always that fish out of water, the dreamer, mm-hmm. the outcast who's in a world that basically laughs at them initially, and they don't fit in, and that they're intimidated by a little bit, but then they always rise to the occasion. And that outsider status, whatever makes them weird, is what makes them special.
Right.
Right? That she's a dancer who dances. She's an exotic dancer and break dancer, but that's
why
she's
bringing something from the streets
into the conservatory.
And it sets her apart.
And Axel Foley bringing...
Right,
something from the streets.
Street smarts from
to
Detroit.
Beverly Hills, yeah. Beverly Hills Detective. You know, and Tom Cruise. What's his character name in Top Gun?
Maverick.
He's the Maverick. And really, you could name every character in a Jerry Bruckheimer movie Maverick.
Yeah.
All the way down to Captain Jack Sparrow. Same exact thing, you know? And I write about more in the piece, but I think that's fascinating. And for some reason, that really resonated in the 80s.
Yeah. But anyway, so Beverly Hills Cop, streaming on Netflix.
All right. This is fantastic, because I really wanted, at one point, I really tried to get Allison to do a Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson
you did,
podcast.
But we're accidentally doing one
You
now.
Didn't want it, but yeah. I told her I was going to make it happen anyway, and I feel like I just did.
Yeah, thank
you. Let's get through the last couple picks here very quickly, because we're starting to go long. And this is a nice segue, because it's another Eddie Murphy movie. Should we perhaps give him maybe like star of the 80s? Like, is he one of the defining actors of the 1980s between
Beverly
Hills Cop,
it was a great era
48 Hours, no. you know, Coming to America, and then my movie, which might be one of the best of all of them, directed by John Landis, who we just mentioned. It's Trading Places from 1983, available on Netflix. And I said earlier that I thought Wall Street was one of maybe the two defining 80s movies, but I think this is, if you can't watch Wall Street because it's not on Netflix, I think this is a nice supplement. This would make a great double feature with Wall Street, don't you think? Because it's about sort of a more humorous look at that sort of greed is good capitalism. It's about these two men whose destinies cross just when they bump into each other on the street. It's Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. He's this wealthy, I don't know, insider trader, whatever he does. He's a stock market guy. He's a genius at the stock market. Eddie Murphy is a beggar, basically, a homeless guy, whatever he is, living on the street. They bump into each other literally on the street one day. Aykroyd, who's, you know, basically, who's essentially racist, assumes this guy who bumped into him is trying to steal his briefcase. Eddie Murphy eventually gets arrested for it. And Aykroyd's employers look at this situation. They're these two brothers who just bicker all the time. And they're horrible, horrible human beings.
Ah, Ezra, right on time. I bet you thought I'd forgotten your Christmas bonus. There you are.
$5. Maybe I'll go to the movies by myself.
Half of it is from me.
Thank you, Mr. Mortimer.
And they've been having this argument about nature versus nurture. And they find that this is a good opportunity for an experiment. They will build Eddie Murphy's character, Billy Ray Valentine, up. They will turn him into Dan Aykroyd's character while destroying Dan Aykroyd's character. Take everything away from him and see, is it the environment that produces the human being, or is it the human being that lives in his environment, nature or nurture? If you've never seen this movie, like, to me, this movie is like an iconic classic, and I assume everyone has seen it, but I really don't know these days. Do you think everyone has seen Trading Places?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Yeah.
Well, if you haven't seen it, it is incredibly funny. Jamie Lee Curtis, also fantastic in this movie, as I guess it's a type. She's sort of the hooker with a heart of gold, I suppose. But in this movie, it's kind of wonderful because she's like the only person with a heart of gold in this movie. Everyone in this movie is, you know, it's just like horrible. Even the heroes, quote unquote. Trading Places, available on Netflix. Another Eddie Murphy, John Landis classic.
All right. Well, we couldn't do a podcast about the 80s without getting at least one John Hughes film in there.
Absolutely not.
So my next pick is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 1986 film, currently streaming on Netflix. It's interesting that John Hughes, you know, made these movies about the strata of high school and like The Breakfast Club, which is your classic, like everyone fits into this category. And even though the point of the film is that they don't, you know, they're more than that, they really do fit into those categories, right? The jock, the princess, the outcast. So it's really interesting that he made this movie in which the main character, Ferris Bueller, played by Matthew Broderick, doesn't really fit a typical high school type, you know?
He's a maverick.
He is like a fantasy character, right? Like everyone likes him.
Yes.
He's smart, but he's not a nerd. He gets along with, like, to the point where not just everyone in his high school likes him, and he's presented as almost a guru, right?
Yeah.
But that
he's a transcendental figure.
He is. That the whole community,
he's almost religious. He's almost a religious icon.
Rallies around him. You know, when the idea
Save
that he
Ferris.
Might be sick, yes, everyone is like ready to come to his rescue, which I think is what, like, you know, if there is the Ferris Fight Club theory, which is that Ferris Bueller does not exist. He is just a fantasy in the
right.
mind of Cameron
yes.
Fry,
yes,
played by Alan Ruck.
I've heard
which
this
I think,
theory.
You know, is a pretty, not necessarily supported, though not necessarily disproven by what is in the film. But I think the spirit of it is interesting because Ferris is this such an outsized character
right.
that you can, he is for like, in the world of a John Hughes movie, a fantasy.
There is a Tyler Durden-ish quality to
yes,
him.
Exactly. He is like everything.
So charismatic, so magnetic.
Yeah, and
so
everything
fun.
Goes well. He can kind of make all of these things happen except for the one certain incident with the car. But
right.
Otherwise, seems magical. He really does
Absolutely.
Like make all of these things happen. And, you know, Matthew Broderick is, he manages to make this character who could potentially be like a little obnoxious into someone who is intensely likable. And, this is probably one of the most rewatchable films I can think of. It's one that if it's on TV, you're going to sit there and watch it because
yep.
how can you not? It's got so many joyous moments.
Has several musical moments.
Yep. Yeah.
And the theme song is so iconic with the, ooh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that wasn't very good, but you know what I'm doing.
I got it. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's funny that someone who's so, this guy is so known for portraying some of the like the pain of high school along with it being funny, like made this film that is basically, it's like almost free of that pain, right?
Yes.
It is like, it just pure like bliss about being young and having the world at your feet, essentially. Like, yeah, even if you have to kind of make that happen.
Ferris Bueller's online too.
Hey, Mr. Rooney, how you doing? Listen, I'm sorry to disturb you at work, but I'm not feeling very well today.
And I was wondering if it might be possible for my sister to bring home any assignments for my classes that I might need.
Have a nice day.
Mr. Peterson? No, I think I owe you an apology, sir.
Well, I should say you do.
I.
Well, I think you should be sorry, for Christ's sake. A family member dies, and you insult me. What the hell is the matter with you anyway?
So that is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, available for streaming on Netflix.
All right. Well, we had to get a little bit, I think, a little bit more action in here, for my taste. This is not, 80s, I think, a lot of action movies. We had to get a little more in there. And here's a movie that I had seen before, maybe twice, maybe three times when I was much younger. I hadn't revisited in a long time, and generally find the series that followed to be unbearable. Perhaps the worst. Let's go out on a limb. I'm going to say it. It's the worst franchise maybe in history. Maybe the Transformers gives it a run for the money. But this is an unbelievably bad franchise. But I actually think, having just rewatched it, there is merit to the original movie. I think it's actually worth watching. It's Highlander from 1986, directed by Russell Mulcahy, available on Netflix. And rewatching it this time on Netflix, Allison, here's my theory. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
Highlander is the Lost of movies.
Okay.
Because it's this really elaborate mythology that is awesome when you don't think about it and when you don't know anything about it. When you get those first few moments when it's a mystery, it is really intoxicating because it starts with you're in this wrestling arena. There's a wrestling match going on. There are these beautiful shots. I couldn't believe how much better shot this movie is than I thought. It's a really good-looking movie. It's very atmospheric, very stylish. And all of a sudden, we're down in like the bowels of Madison Square Garden, and these two dudes in suits are fighting with swords, and one of them beheads the other one, and there's electricity powers, and it's very strange. And then we flash back to Scotland, and one of the two guys is there, and he's seemingly the same age, and he doesn't have a Scottish accent for some reason, which doesn't make any sense. And you don't really understand what's going on, but there's something interesting about it. There's something very appealing about it. And it is a really stylish movie. Then they start explaining everything. And they're immortals. And they have to kill each other. And they're immortal except that they... Well, you can't die unless you get your head cut off. Which seems like a really weird way to determine like immortality and death. Because it's very specific. But seemingly, it's a strange weakness to have. Nonetheless, the more they explain, the less you like it. But I think that there's something to... the look of it, the style of it, the idea of just like this guy dressed in modern dress walking around with a samurai sword. It's sort of an image that's popped up in a few movies. And all the sequels are horrible. They're unwatchable. And that's being kind. They're just brutal. But there's something to this movie. And rewatching it, I really thought there is something here. I get now why they kept trying to remake it or make sequels. The thing is, you can't make a sequel to a movie that's called, you know, this tagline is "there can be only one." When that is your tagline, you have ruined any possibility of sequels. Nonetheless, they tried.
I don't like boats. I don't like water. I'm a man, not a fish.
You complain endlessly.
You look like a woman, you stupid haggis.
Haggis? What is haggis?
Sheep's stomach stuffed with meat and barley.
And what do you do with it?
You eat it. How revolting. Achoo. Be still, for God's sake. You'll tip us over.
So?
I cannot swim, you Spanish peacock.
I'm not Spanish. I'm Egyptian.
You said you were from Spain. You're a liar.
You have the manners of a goat. And you smell like a dung heap. And you have no knowledge whatsoever of your potential. Now! Get out! No!
If you've never seen Highlander, and you're willing to sort of just accept the mystery parts, you'll enjoy it. It's a really beautiful-looking movie. Maybe one of the better-looking action movies of the 80s. It's Highlander. It is available on Netflix.
All right. And one last pick. We've got... another classic. I wanted to fit in a romantic comedy in here, but there really weren't any that I wanted to do When Harry Met Sally, but it's only on Xfinity Stream Picks and it's expiring soon.
Okay.
So instead, I went with another kind of teen sort of action movie. Which is You're the Best. The Karate Kid.
It's the best.
It is the best. 1984. Streaming on Netflix.
I demanded one of us. When we saw that it was available, I said one of us has to do Karate Kid.
I had to. Yeah. And, you know, I think that this is a movie that... it's a really well-made movie for, you know, that.
But just look, we didn't intend this on purpose, Allison, but look at, this is another movie about an outsider,
yes,
fish out of water story. Yes. He comes from what, Jersey?
Newark, yes.
He comes from Newark. He goes to California.
To
he's
the
an outsider. He's an outcast. He's weird. He doesn't fit in. But there's something special about him, isn't there, Allison?
There is. And he, you know, he works hard and he succeeds. In the end, spoiler alert. Ralph Macchio as Danny LaRusso. Pat Morita as Mr. Miyagi. Elizabeth Shue as Ally Mills. And as you said, it's about how Daniel LaRusso moves from New Jersey reluctantly with his mom to California. Where he has a tough time, but he also he doesn't have that, you know, like he's not a loner, like he meets people immediately. And what I really like is that, you know, his relationship with Elizabeth Shue's character gets actually a fair amount of screen time. Mm-hmm. Like they spend time together. Yeah. She is not like
they get to go on a date.
They go on dates. They kind of you know, they have like a really kind of cute rapport.
Yes.
Which she is not just kind of the girl who is snagged as part of his, you know, move towards a karate dominance. It is not, you know, she's like,
no, actually, you're absolutely
very
right.
She's like a pretty well-formed character as love interests go. And but, you know, the heart of this movie is Danny's relationship with Mr. Miyagi. And it is really sweet. Like, it is really well handled. You know, given that this is a movie that's basically about an exotic culture as filtered through white experience, right? Mr. Miyagi is by far one of the best depictions of an Asian character in this era. Like, 1984 was also the year of 16 Candles and Long Duck Dong.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, which is, I think, still like a really horrible black mark on on Hollywood's record, and really not that long ago.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, as much as Mr. Miyagi kind of breaks down to a lot of catchphrases, stilted catchphrases.
And the accent.
Like, he is also, given a lot of nobility and, you know, a really kind of sad backstory in which he fought for the U.S. and while his family was put into an internment camp. And, you know, and despite that, is not bitter about his service, at least. And I think that
he sort of rises above the stereotype. That
he does.
Is what,
yeah.
what you're saying.
Did you fix my bike?
Aye.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Are those real trees?
Would you like see? Come inside.
Well, thanks. I think it's so small.
I train. Here, tie there.
Where'd you learn how? Japan?
Okinawa.
What's that?
My country. China here, Japan here, Okinawa here.
It's really not as bad as many
as
of them have been. Yeah, I don't know. I think that he's really not, I think he gets unfairly maligned, given that I think the thing that you would argue is just that this is a movie about a lot of white people, you know, kind of glomming on to karate.
Case could be made, I suppose.
Right.
And let me tell you something. In the 80s, we loved it. I had the Karate Kid headband, you know, this was a thing. This is another, this is like the zeitgeist. We were talking about, like, catching a zeitgeist and turning it into its own thing. Like, every kid wanted to be the Karate Kid after this.
Yeah, well, I think that, because it makes karate look great.
Yes!
And I think that, you know, one of the things that's, like, going back and looking at this movie again, was that it's directed by John G. Avildsen, who directed Rocky as well, by the way, that...
And there may be a few minor similarities between the two.
And other films that we've talked about, yes. I think that one of the things that's interesting about the way this film is structured is that you know, as big as the tournament looms in it, it's really not that much in the runtime. You know, this is like a 2-hour movie. It's really left to like the last, I think, 15 or 20 minutes. Whereas I feel like these days, the tournament aspect would like grow to take up like half the movie in something similar. But the point of the movie is really his relationship, you know, his relationship with Ally and his relationship with Mr. Miyagi and with his mom as well. You know, that these are, that's given a lot of time. The training is given a lot of time. And what happens towards the end is just a realization of how he's grown as a person. So that is The Karate Kid, a classic streaming on Netflix. Nothing's gonna ever take me down. Nothing's gonna ever take me down.
Allison. We're very pleased once again to be sponsored by MoviePass this week. MoviePass lets you watch unlimited movies in theaters around the country for a flat monthly rate. You check in using an app on your smartphone and buy your ticket with a membership card, and it works for any new release, though it doesn't cover 3D or IMAX.
If you go to the movies several times a month, you might want to check MoviePass out. Do the math. It might work out for you. Instead of paying per ticket, you pay a flat fee for the month that gets you entry to one film per day. Check out moviepass.com/filmspotting for more info and use the offer code FILMSPOTTING to get $10 off the first month of your subscription.
You guys really are cowboys.
What's your problem, Kazansky?
You're everyone's problem. That's because every time you go up in the air, you're unsafe. I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right. Ice, man, I am dangerous.
Maverick, you and Goose get your butts out of that flight gear and up to Viper's office now.
Now it's time for the Listener's Choice review and narrowly beating out A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. Is Top Gun, the 1986 film directed by the late Tony Scott, currently streaming on Netflix. You know, as we said, the 1980s were the era of the blockbuster, the decade that came into what was promised by Jaws and films like that. It's also the decade that was reliant on stars in a way that I think our blockbusters aren't today. You know, these days you see much more kind of unknowns or actors who are basically just picked because they're photogenic and hopefully they look good on screen and can line read, but it's the franchise or the effects that are the star that come first. But Top Gun is all about Tom Cruise as Pete Maverick Mitchell, a naval aviator. You know, Cruise was not quite 24 when this film came out. He'd already had a few lead roles under his belt, Risky Business and Legend. But this really cemented his celebrity. And I think he does hold up as a testament to star power in this way. He's very watchable here as the cocky but still immature Maverick, who's one hell of an instinctive pilot, but maybe not a reliable wingman. you know, Tony Scott made Top Gun after The Hunger and before Beverly Hills Cop 2, which we just mentioned. The film was produced by the team of Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, two of the big names in blockbusters. It also stars Anthony Edwards as Maverick's Rio Goose, Val Kilmer as his rival, Tom Iceman Kazansky, Tom Skerritt and Michael Ironside as instructors Viper and Jester, and Kelly McGillis as Charlie, the civilian instructor Maverick falls in love with. The film also features a few more now familiar faces in smaller roles, including Meg Ryan as Goose's wife, Tim Robbins as Merlin, and even Adrian Pasdar is in there in a little role as well.
I didn't see him.
Yes. Like so many films featuring the military, Top Gun was made, in this case, with the help of the Navy, a help that comes with script approval. So, Matt, I wanted to start by asking you what you thought of this film's depiction of war. As Viper says, we don't make policy. And that's about as far as the movie really gestures in that direction. In fact, the enemy is only referred to as the other side, never named. They wear dark helmets to obscure their features. And the only identifying mark is, you know, maybe a vaguely communist affiliated red star on their planes. You know, the film provided a giant boost in enlistment to the Navy, as well as to sales of aviator glasses. So what did you think of this film's maybe freedom from thought in terms of what it means to go shoot people down?
Yeah, that to me, that was maybe the most interesting part about rewatching it. And obviously, I've seen this movie before, but it's been quite a few years. And man, what a crazy fantasy of war this movie is. I mean, you could not make a more idealized portrait of war as a good thing. And not only like as a good thing, as like an almost an easy thing in a moral sense. Because as you said, the enemy is so faceless and so generic, and you know, they're not identifiable as an other, you know? So it, first of all, you could sell this movie anywhere around the world because it, you know, it's not like, you know, oh, we got to get those Germans and then you can't show it in Germany, you know? It's this unbelievable fantasy. They're not even shooting anyone down. This is a war without violence because what are they doing? They're not shooting. They're getting missile locks. It's like all you have to do to win is just get a missile lock. Victory through missile lock, Allison. You know, there's almost no death, really, other than one character who dies, which I won't reveal. No one dies in this movie. There's no killing. Just chasing. It's basically like war as a expression of personal style, essentially. You know, that Maverick gets to, like, very famously in one scene, like, beat a guy by, like, going upside down and kind of, like, flying right above his cockpit, like cockpit to cockpit, and he's upside down. there's no killing. There's no death. You know, it's funny you mentioned that there's no politics, that they're not politicians. We're just the instruments. But there's almost no there's no thought that there might be politics in this. What would there be to be political about? They're just a bunch of hotshot cool guys flying through the skies and missile locking each other and not shooting.
Yeah, I had never really understood, like, not until I went back and rewatched it this time, had I really realized that they never name the enemy. I'd always kind of assume that it was
they are the
Russians,
enemy,
right? But it's the enemy, the
right.
enemy. Like, you never, there's no mention of country. There's no even mention of direction. When they're out, when they actually have combat moments, they're like in the middle of the Indian Ocean,
right?
Right? Beyond that,
take your pick.
Could be, yeah.
Anyone in that vicinity,
right.
It could be the bad guy.
Exactly.
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. So, and, you know, other than that, like, there's this vague sense of, like, when they talk about an actual conflict that happened, right, or sort of one, like, with Maverick's dad, they're like, oh, you know, well, the reason we can't talk about it because it was on the wrong side of, like, the enemy lines, but, like, you know, obviously that he was a hero. Like, so, you know, it's all just about.
But it was classified. We can't talk about it. Right.
Yeah.
It's almost like actual war is verboten in this movie.
Right.
And oh, that was a real war. People died. We can't talk about it. And in this movie, it's like all the current stuff. Well, that's actual war. We're not going to talk. This is a movie about training.
Yeah. Training.
Awesome training.
And then also just like swagger, right?
Yeah.
Like, so much of this is about posturing and
being
swagger
awesome.
And being the best, being number one.
Right.
Right.
War is about being awesome and looking really cool with your aviator shades, as you said, and coming up with cool catchphrases like, I feel the need for speed, and having a cool catch, like a sign, your name, like being Maverick or Iceman or Merlin, or, you know, everyone has a cool call sign and their own helmets that are all decorated. It's all an expression of personal style and swagger.
Yeah. Well, so in that vein,
yes.
we joked about this, like, I think when we were talking about this last time, but this movie is kind of infamous for accidental homoeroticism.
Yes.
It even became the subject of a famous Quentin Tarantino monologue in his like a very small role in a not very well-known 1994 indie. It's best known for this monologue called Sleep With Me, in which he talks about at a party how, quote, one of the greatest scripts ever written in the history of Hollywood is Top Gun. It is a story about a man's struggle with his own homosexuality. And then goes on this lengthy theory that is even more elaborate than the Ferris Fight Club theory about what the movie actually means. It was just, what do you think of the relationship between Maverick and Iceman in this? Because it is kind of, I feel like accidentally in like being so macho, it crosses over often into like.
Well, there you go. That's what it is. It is so over the top, you know, preening, posturing, being a tough dude, and that it does absolutely. It crosses over from like threatening to flirting. They do seem at times like they are flirting.
They always get up in each other's faces.
Oh, yeah,
they're wearing towels.
Right, like they want to kiss each other.
Yes.
You know, and they're like challenging each other the way you might, you know, like when my wife and I met, like our first time we ever met was at a bowling alley. And we were with a bunch of friends, but we started like kind of like challenging each other bowling, and we kind of like started sitting next to each other and sort of like being challenging and flirtatious. That is exactly the relationship between Iceman and Maverick to a T.
Yeah.
Like, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, also you see the film struggle with, they're like, how do we work a romance into this while really wanting to remain contained in the world of
the fighter school.
So they try as hard as possible to have Kelly McGillis's character be one of the boys, right? Even her call sign is Charlie, and she works there.
Right.
And she is also, she's not a pilot because she can't be a pilot, but she is part of this world. You know, like what the film ends with them like re-encountering each other and then planes flying off into the distance, as if, you know, like that's the real romance would be ideally, if they are two pilots like flying off into this distance together. But that can't happen. So you have the closest thing that can happen, which is her being like,
you know, that's, I hadn't thought about this particularly, but you're absolutely right. Like in the idealized world of like a screenwriting, like in terms of what a screenwriting school would tell you to do, the ideal ending is for Maverick and Iceman to become lovers,
exactly.
and to fly off together.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right. That's it. A screenwriting school would tell you that that's the right ending of the movie.
Yeah.
And they would probably just write out Charlie wouldn't even be a character, I guess.
Right, exactly. Because I mean, like that aspect of the romance is It's like a little awkward, I would say, because it like running parallel to the storyline, because she's supposed to be using him to get information.
Yeah, that doesn't quite
like
work.
It's a little awkward. But
the one thing that's interesting about them now in 2013 to watch is the fact that she is so visibly older than him.
Yes.
She's not an old woman.
No.
But she's clearly, I don't know, maybe
she's got like 5 years on
him,
I think.
Yeah. Somewhere in there. And that is so the reverse of every movie we get now, where it's still Tom Cruise is still the romantic lead in these movies, and his girlfriends are getting young. They stay. It's like McConaughey and Dazed and Confused. He gets older, they stay the same age. You know,
totally.
Like they're all still Kelly McGillis's age. So I thought that was interesting that we were allowed to have sort of a more mature woman,
yeah,
still beautiful and sexy and alluring, and you get why he's into her. Or pretending, depending on your perspective on the movie, but that she's allowed to be a little bit older than him. And I thought that was really refreshing now, because we never see a movie like that
now. And also, like, that part of the what's difficult about their romance is the fact that he is like a cocky kid and she's a little more mature. She's more mature and she's like grown up, you know? And so that she kind of gets a little exasperated with him, his posturing and the way he acts, and you know, his pickup move at the bar, you know, like I think that, especially in this movie, I've also like in this new movie I noticed much more than I think I ever have in his later movies that he's much shorter than a lot of the other guys, you know.
He is shorter in this movie,
and like I think that maybe that's something as he became a kind of bigger star in this like
he had
grand
to be
sense that you never
bigger.
Saw him being dwarfed by people.
That's
in the way that he is in this movie.
He's a little underdogish
he
in that way in this
underdog.
movie.
Yeah, and you know, I think, and I also I really like his relationship with Goose. I feel like they have like a real like they do a really good like solid friendship like bromance, and I think that like that's it's one of the better parts of the movie as well, that like they just have known each other so well, you know.
And in the idealized version we've discussed, their relationship would be a bone of contention because probably Goose is in love with him, right?
There's
he's in love with Maverick.
There's no Meg Ryan.
Goose is in love with Maverick, but Maverick doesn't reciprocate, and that creates some sort of tension. So that, you know, perhaps at the end there's some sort of sacrifice that's involved, which gives more guilt to Maverick. We've rewritten this movie.
But I think that this is why in Starship Troopers, all like the women were allowed to fight as well, you know, so that you could like be like, what you really want is a romance between the soldiers, and just cut out the extraneous love interest who's along the side.
Yeah.
So,
all right, last thing. If you went to Top Gun, fighter school, whatever it's called, what would your call sign be, Allison?
Oh my God, you can't just spring this on me. I don't know. What would your call sign be?
I have no idea, but I just thought we gotta maybe listeners can suggest our call signs.
I think you can't choose your own call sign. It has to be given to you.
You don't think Tom Cruise walked in and was like, hey guys, I'm Maverick.
Well, come on. Do you think that Anthony Edwards chose Goose?
Probably not. Maybe not.
So, yeah, there you go. So, if you have suggestions, please write
let's hear them. SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. Send us your feedback about Top Gun, but also, what should our call signs be? Maybe we'll start calling each other. We'll abandon Allison and Matt, and we'll just go by whatever you guys give us. I think that would be the right thing to do. Well, that's Top Gun, and it's playing in theaters now, briefly. If you hear this quick enough, I think it's still playing in theaters in IMAX 3D. One can only imagine the volleyball scene in IMAX 3D. They're rippling sweaty muscles in IMAX 3D. If you don't want to go to the theater, though, it is also available for streaming on Netflix. Okay, before we wrap things up with Behind the 8-Ball, we are going to announce the winner of our keyword game from two podcasts ago. We didn't have time to do it last show, and even though we've gone long, we're gonna squeeze it in here. All right, Allison, what were the keywords we gave to our listeners on that two podcasts ago?
They were small town, racism, based on book, what happened to epilogue, and locker room.
We had a lot of incorrect guesses. Some different people were on the right track, but not quite. Remember the Titans was a popular incorrect guess. What was the correct guess?
Was Friday Night Lights,
the movie.
Yes.
Not as good as the TV show.
No, I would agree.
But still good.
Still good.
It was a Texas movies was the theme that episode. That is certainly a clear Texas movie. And ironically enough, Allison, our winner is from Texas. Eddie Strait from Austin, Texas. Congratulations. Email us, SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. We will get you your prize. And the winner of our previous keyword game, I've got the two prizes together. I'm going to mail them both at the same time. So don't despair. Your prizes are coming. Let's get one correction from our last episode before we get to Behind the 8-Ball. I incorrectly said during our last Behind the 8-Ball segment that the documentary Undefeated was nominated but did not win the Oscar for Best Documentary last year. Allison, undefeated, rightfully and happily did win the Oscar for Best Documentary last year. So I apologize for the mistake. I'm glad it won. It was a very good documentary, which you should watch. So now, with that in mind, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball. Allison, you're going to start this week?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's begin with three new releases.
Okay, first off is Le Cercle Rouge, which is new on Hulu. This is 1970 French film directed by Jean-Pierre Melville. Stars Alain Delon, André Bourvil, that's how you say it, and so on. Yves Montand as well. And all of them just look impossibly cool. This is just a great heist film and one that's been very influential on people like John Woo. So it's one that is great to see, just to also see how many people it's influenced. That is new on Hulu. Also new on Hulu is My Brilliant Career, 1979 Australian film directed by Gillian Armstrong, who also did Oscar and Lucinda and The Last Days of Xenu, and stars a great Judy Davis as Sybilla, who is a free-spirited girl in the late 19th century in Australia who has the opportunity to marry a young man played by Sam Neill, who is like the ideal suitor, but instead wants to maintain her independence and become a writer. It's a really charming movie. And finally, the new on Netflix is The Best of Youth, a 2003 Italian miniseries directed by Marco Tullio Giordana. It played at Cannes in 2003, and it's like in a 354-minute run. Like it was lengthy, and I think it was even longer in the form that went on Italian TV, but the one on Netflix is 354 minutes. It's a family saga. It's set in Italy. It runs from like 1966 through to 2003 and looks at primarily two brothers in this family going from like the 60s and the counterculture days into parenthood and everything. And it's really great. It's just a very terrific large scale spanning of a family drama. So that is Best of Youth. It is now playing on Netflix.
All right, two expiring titles.
First up, expiring February 17th from Netflix, is Me and Orson Welles, 2008 film from Richard Linklater. Not Linklater's best, but it does feature a great performance from Christian McKay as
great,
Orson Welles.
Great
performance. He is fantastic, yes. And also, it's got Zac Efron in it.
Boom!
So that is expiring from Netflix on February 17th. Expiring on February 20th is Until the Light Takes Us. This is a 2009 documentary from directors Aaron Eitz and Audrey Ewell about Norwegian black metal, the most dark of metal. And it's it includes an interview with Varg Vercanus.
Not the Varg Vercanus.
He is kind of he is infamous. Burzum is his band, his one person band. But you know,
I know what Varg Vercanus' band is called.
He's more famous, perhaps, for murdering another musician. I think he's interviewed in jail in the documentary. So that is expiring on February 20th.
Okay, and one random film from your queue.
You gave me number 77, which is Nostalgia for the Light, 2010 documentary directed by Patricio Guzman about this desert in Chile, and it's where astronomers are studying stars while people are looking for looking through the soil for family members who are buried there because the nation has a tough political past. So I've heard nothing but great things about it, but have never gotten around to seeing it. So that is Nostalgia for the Light. That's streaming on Netflix. All right, Matt, it is your turn.
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Three new films.
I'm going to start with available on Crackle, a film entitled Vacancy. This is a 2007 horror film from one of my favorite sort of unsung genre directors of the moment, up and coming. His name is Nimrod Antal. The movie he directed that I really, really like is named Armored. It was like a really small scale but very gritty, termite art-ish crime saga. This is his like horror movie. It's a couple that's trapped at a hotel. Very classical in setup and style, but very effective. It's available on Crackle for free if you've never seen it. It's worth checking out. Available on Hulu is the film Decoding Deepak, which is a documentary about Deepak Chopra made by his son, Gautam Chopra, which sounds, I know, just awful. It sounds awful. But I thought this movie was actually pretty interesting, and not even so much about him per se. It's just a documentary about a father and a son, and a son who's sort of in his father's shadow, and what it's like to have a famous father and to try to deal with that. I found pretty interesting. So that's Decoding Deepak. It's available on Hulu. And for our Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners who are following along with the Marx Brothers Marathon that Film Spotting is doing right now, you can watch the 12th Marx Brothers movie, A Night in Casablanca. That is now available on Hulu. I've actually never seen that one. I am a big Marx Brothers fan. I don't know how I feel about them watching all these movies and kind of bashing them. I don't know if you're following along with this marathon, Allison, on our sister show. They haven't been giving the most sterling praise to the Marx Brothers, so we may have to, I don't know how, but may need to fix this situation somehow. Anyway, A Night in Casablanca by the Marx Brothers, available on Hulu.
Two expiring films.
Expiring on February 15th is actually a television show, which I watched the whole thing of with my wife. We enjoyed it. It's called, let me say this. Allison, do you like any or all of the following things? Dirt, sex, and or money?
Yes.
Then you'll probably enjoy Dirty Sexy Money, which was a short-lived but entertainingly soapy television show that ran on ABC from 2007 to 2009. It was about this very powerful New York family, the Darlings, who rely on their lawyer to bail them out of all these tough, morally conflicted situations. It's kind of the show that I want Nashville to become. Tawdry, sleazy, a little silly, but a lot of fun with all these rich people plotting and sniping at each other with a very good cast. Peter Krause, Donald Sutherland, and Jill Clayburgh, among many others. That's on Netflix until February 15th. And then expiring on February 17th on Netflix is Hugh Hefner, Playboy, Activist, and Rebel, 2010 documentary about the Playboy, Activist, and Rebel Hugh Hefner. Allison, this is why 4 out of 5 dentists agree my plot summaries are really outstanding. This doc premiered at the 2009 Toronto Film Festival. Features contributions from George Lucas, Bill Maher, Jenny McCarthy, Shannon Tweed, and many, many more. Allison, I haven't seen it, but I'm going to watch it this week for the articles.
And one expiring title.
You gave me number 33, which this time is Basquiat, Julian Schnabel's film about the legendary New York graffiti artist. I have to admit, even though I love The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, one of my all-time favorite movies, that movie just changed my life, essentially. I've never seen Basquiat. I've never seen Julian Schnabel's first feature film. I don't know why I haven't gotten around to it yet, but I have to at some point. Have you seen it? Is it worth my time?
Yeah, it is. I like it.
All right, well, I'll have to watch it. Basquiat, that's on Netflix. Okay, normally on the show, we would do our listener's choice options now, but we're actually going to eschew listener's choice for our next episode, and that is because our next episode, God and the technology lords and my equipment willing, is going to be our live show. Certainly the live show is going to happen, but we're hoping it will record and we'll be able to use that as our next episode, Allison. If you haven't gotten your tickets, we have a very few left. They are available now at videology.info. It's going to be Saturday, February 23rd at 6:30. Tickets are $8. You get a movie, which is going to be Compliance. You get a Q&A with director Craig Zobel. He's going to be joining us via Skype. So we'll talk to him after the movie. And we're going to be doing a slightly modified version of our usual podcast. You want to tell people what we'll be talking about, Allison?
Well, we will be talking about House of Cards.
That's going to be our main, in lieu of a listener's choice review.
Yes. So, you know, it's the Netflix original series.
Right, it's available
directed,
now.
First two episodes directed by David Fincher, written by Beau Willimon, who is a playwright as well. So we're going to be digging into that since, you know, it is a kind of important moment
yeah.
in streaming.
This is a very big deal, and we threw it out on Twitter if people would be interested. By overwhelmingly, people said, yes, we want to hear you guys talk about it. So we think this is something everyone who's got Netflix, at least, will be able to watch before we get there. So it'll be out for a while. You could maybe do a little spoilery discussion.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to jump right to whatever happens in the last episode. But, you know, you've got some time to dig into it, at least a little.
Yes.
And, you know, it's one that I'm really interested to talk about.
Right.
You are as well.
So that's going to be sort of the main review. We're going to also talk about what it represents, because this is, like Allison said, this is a big thing. So we're going to talk about binge watching. We're going to be talking about television in the age of Netflix. We'll do that. Maybe we'll do a very brief segment on the Oscars, which will be the next day for the live audience. We'll make our predictions and maybe have some sort of really silly wager. And we're also going to do some giveaways. I've got a huge stack of DVDs and Blu-rays right next to me, Allison. I mean, it is big.
It is.
So we'll play
it's
the
almost falling down on you, actually.
Yeah, so we're going to play the keyword game. And I think we've talked some other ideas for things. And we've got the Blu-rays, we've got the DVDs. I already talked about maybe we'll have some free drinks for people because Videology is as a bar as well. So it's going to be a good time. We're going to have a lot of fun. Please come out. We're really excited that so many people have bought tickets already. We've got a few still available. And again, Saturday, February 23rd, 6:30, and you can buy your ticket at videology.info.
And you can send your feedback for the episode in general to svu@filmspottingsvu.com. FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discussed on the episode. The FilmSpotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the TV review, in this case, of our choice. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/AllisonWilmore and twitter.com/MattSinger. And you can follow the show at FilmSpotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, though there won't be one in this next episode. It's also where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. For FilmSpotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.